Okay, so the next question on this is, what contract term should be the highest priority for upcoming contract negotiations with the teachers union? And we talked about this. Sherry and I spent a lot of time going through these questions, and we really feel this is beyond the scope of what we were asked to do, because remember, we were told not to touch that area. So it's beyond our scope. But again, doing a performance audit would let you know those areas that would be either too much money that should be talked about or not. I know anecdotally heard a little bit about the sick time, and I would say maybe you look at whether it's sick time or whether you put people on or have TDI to do that. That could be a question in the performance audit. Ask that question and say, do you save money or do you not save money? And then that's a negotiable item that you could work with. But we feel it's outside our scope to deal with anything in the contract. Oh, it says, has been, the next one, it says, it has been said that grant federal funding creates expense revenue recognition issues due to the delay variability of reimbursements for Medicare, Medicaid expenses. What was reviewed in this area? And what enhancements are in place to improve visibility to this? Well, just so you know, again, I keep saying what a treasure they have by hiring the finance director. The new finance director has already identified issues in this area and has a skill set to address the identified expenditures that were excluded from reimbursements that should have been included. He addressed it in the first week that he came here. So you jump right on that one right away. The next one is, what grant-funded positions, if any, were retained beyond the funding available? Have these been removed, alternative funding secured, and what are the next steps? And we talked about process improvements, employee grant controls will address this, incorporating finance and superintendent in the grant approval process. The reason why we said that is grants were being approved not at the finance director and the superintendent level, which is where they should be. That's one of the process improvements the vice chair mentioned that we talked to them and they will be instituting here. Because every grant, when you read a grant, throughout my whole career, if I've seen you get a grant, and I'll make it up, say it's for $1 million to hire 10 people at $100,000 a year. Everyone in the business knows, you tell all the employees, I've got enough money to pay a salary for 1 year, 2 years, whatever it is. And at the end of that 1 year or 2 years, you don't have a job. That's unless we get another grant. That wasn't being done here, number one. And number two, the other piece is that you shouldn't have people applying for grants without the finance director and the superintendent's approval, because they may require matching grants. So I could ask, I can come back and say, I'm really excited, I got a $1 million grant. Oh, by the way, the city's going to kick in $250,000. Well, you should know that ahead of time before you allow someone to apply for a grant and get a grant, to know what the commitment is. So those processes are involved, have been recommended and already being executed by the superintendent and the finance director. And I'm sorry for the walking back and forth. The next one, giving back to the vice chair.
And to further touch on the grants a little bit more, not just knowing what the match is, but really understanding what the requirements are when you're accepting the grants. We just recently had purchases brought to us for approval through grant funding that were for travel reimbursements for enhanced airline seats. And the federal guidance, when you accept federal awards, even if they're passed through from the state, you still have to abide by the federal guidance, specifically states that you have to purchase the cheapest seats available. So not abiding by that may never come up, may never be identified by the oversight boards, the U.S. Department of Ed. But if they did, that jeopardizes our current funding. It means that the Department of Ed could ask for prior funding back, or they could deny future funding. So it's very important to update the policies to make sure that they're in alignment with what the federal guidance is, because that's what you're agreeing to abide by when you accept the funds. And I will say that immediately the finance director updated the travel policy to reflect the specific language in the guidance. And so it's a good example of immediate action, and going forward, as long as these things are continuing, we will be in better shape. So the next question from Councilman Gebhardt is, what financial controls have been implemented at the direction of the Budget Commission, and what impact should we see from these controls? We haven't formally approved approved the implementation of any policies. I think that will probably be the next meeting, if not the one after that. So we can get those to you certainly as soon as that happens. But high level, we've already gone over the grant tracking, reconciliations of payroll, reconciliations of your two reports from HR and payroll, and implementing better budgeting tools.
And keep in mind that all of these controls will help to reduce the chance that this would happen again, overspending on the budget. Next question was, what is the status of the Munis implementation? How does this simplify a streamlined integration with city finances? I mentioned this a little bit earlier, but just very quickly, city side already uses Munis, so at the school using it, they'll be able to talk in the same language to each other, to share information. And we do know that the city, the school department has already started training. And as I mentioned before, just keep in mind, there's a lot put on them. They have to handle paying their expenses and running the school department and instituting software. Whenever I see in software throughout my whole career, there's always a hiccup in there. So there might be some, but I think you got the right team in there with the training. They'll get it going, and it'll probably take this full year before things are running smoothly by using new software. The next one was, are there areas you sought to review but you were unable to, either due to limitation of time or bandwidth? We had no restriction based on time or bandwidth. As I mentioned to you, from myself, the vice chair, and Angela, we came to the school department. We spent weekends, nights, we reviewed all kinds of things. Nothing would stop us from doing our job, so that is not the case. The only one is that I mentioned in the beginning, the statute that created us had a big carve out in there. That would be the only one, but that's not your question here. So this is easy for us because we wrote down me and Ernie, so we know who to hand it to.
And the next question, what were your key learnings and aha moments? We've already touched on those. It was the calculation of the FICA and Medicare was because of how easy it was. That was a real like brain scratcher, for lack of a better term. And the other one was just the overall just lack of policies and procedures and controls. I don't know if the chairman has anything to add, but I think it's,
one of the things that we realize out of all of this is, keep in mind, this problem from a high level was not a problem based on lack of revenue. It was based on lack of controls. If you had the right controls in place, they would have developed this trust between the council, the city side, and the school, even the school committee. The school committee, in fairness to them, they weren't getting the right information presented to them. Just as it changed for all of you, it was changed for them. So I would say to you that it's the controls that was the issue. The right controls, developing trust, having accountability, having the right reporting mechanism, catching things early so you could stop them so they don't spiral out of control. That's really the problem here. And now it's just making up for past deficits and moving forward and instituting these controls in place. So back to you.
I think it's the last question is, what does the Warwick School Department need to focus on for the next 3 to 5 years to ensure a successful financial future? First and foremost, again, like a broken record, implement strong internal controls and policies. And I think it's important to note, they're not set it and forget it. So it should be a continuous process. There should be a mechanism for review and assessment. Hey, something that is a best practice didn't really work for us. How can we make it better? There needs to be a process for that too. The other thing that I think people fail to realize when there's financial issues in organizations is you really need to maintain a strong finance department and do what you can. You have a very good department. I audit a lot of organizations, and your finance director is one of the best I've worked with. So maintain your finance department.
And if I could just add to that, 100% correct. But it also involves mentoring, which would be provided, mentoring, leadership, which you have in this individual, and training. Those things will help develop a stronger, you have young professionals in there really stood up and did great things with little. With a little proper training, they're going to be superstars. I think they already are. They've learned a lot, but.
Yes, I was just going to say that. Do what you can to keep them and to continue to invest in them, because it's very hard to find people who are qualified and also have the ambition and the dedication, and you've got that. So, and then the last thing I would add is continued collaboration and transparency with the city. I think this process really seemed to improve that. And I think ongoing communication and collaboration and the transparency is essential. It ensures a shared financial interest. Everybody's on the same page. There's no surprises. There's no tension. I think it's paramount to make it work.
Okay.
That's it for Mr. Gebhardt's question.
So, and we have more questions.
Yeah, you have.
I have yours. Oh, it's on this one. We planned on standing right next to each other, but no, with this. No.
So you're 1, 2, and 3.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah. I figured it'd be easier for you if we were at 2 separate ones, but forgot we only had 1 set with the answers. The first one, if the commission's hands weren't tied by enabling legislation, what would be the additional actions taken and proposed by the commission, including the following: salary reductions, school closures, elimination of staffing positions, increasing the size of classrooms, reducing staffing through attrition? I would say all of those, we would apply the same rigor that we apply towards all the other expenditures. All of these would be on the table if we were doing that. So, but even if you gave us the opportunity to do that, I understand and I follow collective bargaining agreements. I know part of that is negotiation. So that would be the process. But we would raise all those issues. And in the future contracts, because that was a previous question, they all should be talked about. But I think if you had a performance audit and had the data to back it up, then you have a valid reason why you're saying you want to make these changes, because it's based on facts. The next one was, if the city council approves additional funding for the fiscal year, will that automatically be added to the maintenance of effort, which I was strong, I won't add the extra piece. But does it add to maintenance of effort? So let me explain maintenance of effort for you. If you, let's say previous year's deficits, if you fund those, that does not add to maintenance of effort. And I'm not a lawyer, I'm a CPA, I've done audits in this space. I'm speaking as an auditor, not as a lawyer. But what happens is, year's over, you have a deficit, you fund that, that's not maintenance of effort. You, like the one we're talking about now, the $2 million shortfall, you fund that now, that becomes maintenance of effort. That would not be our recommendation anyways, you'll hear at the end. But if you do fund it now fully, that would become maintenance of effort. The next one is, if city council does not approve the $2.2 request for additional funding by the school department, what is the recommendation from the budget commission to the school department to balance their budget for fiscal year 2026? Keep it in mind, as I mentioned, that we couldn't touch the payroll piece. To me, you have a few options. Number one, you could fund it. Keep it in mind, if you did fund it, that adds to maintenance of effort. Number two, if you don't fund it, which is not a bad option if you really think about this. If you didn't fund it and you allowed the school department to spend according to the budget that we recommend, but always searching and looking for through attrition in other areas to reduce expenditures, that 2.2 million with them, the school committee can make changes that we couldn't make, so they can make changes. And the superintendent and the finance director can make changes throughout the year. So let's just say, for example, we're saying this budget is 2.2 million short. If you said, I'm not going to fund it, because it is an option, so we have to talk about that. If you say, I'm not going to fund it, and you say, I want you, the school department, to look at avenues to reduce costs further, who knows, maybe at the end of the year, by finding cuts through attrition, people leaving, they could get that 2.2 million down to 1.8 million. And then you can fund that at the end of the year. But now you'll know that the school side did extra effort to reduce that number, and you could still fund it. I mean, we all know you as a council, a mayor, you have a lot of other interests you have to solve. You have police, fire, public works. It's not just school. Everyone has to understand that you have a lot to balance. And so the school department, it can be put on them to try to find other avenues. And there's, like, I can go to a low level. Let's say we talked about, even in our commission, about purchasing. Purchasing of, let's say, supplies. Bring it up to the finance director level. Bring it up to a higher level, because what's happening is you have some teachers and some personnel that want to buy from Amazon. Someone might want to buy from WB Mason. And let's just say, for example, they spend $10,000 here and $10,000 WB Mason. But then what a little, we talked about it, and if you talk to one of them, they say, I'll give you a discount, anything above $10,000. Well, why won't you spend all $20,000 at WB Mason and get the discount instead of doing 10 here and 10 here? Those decisions of purchasing shouldn't be at any other level other than the finance director level. So it should be up at that level so they could figure out how to save money by purchasing in bulk, or maybe even combining purchasing with the city side to reduce expenses. And I'm going to take number five on this page. Number four is you, but I'll do five and then we'll give it to you. So number five is, what action, if any, will be taken by the commission of the auditor general with regards to the school department filing a balanced budget for fiscal years 23, 24, 25, when that was not the case? Well, we have no power. I would say for us as a commission, we don't have the power to institute anything that they didn't have a balanced budget. What would happen is, I know the mayor is looking at addressing 23 and 24, the shortfall in 2023 and 2024, that 1.2 million in total. So I'll leave that to the mayor to decide what he's going to propose to you, what to do with that number. And for 25, we actually don't know what that number is until the audit's done by the auditors, which you won't get until December 31st. So it's, in my whole career, I don't deal with hypothetical things. We don't know what that number is. But think about it. You didn't give us the power. We don't have the power to do anything with that. So that would be at the state level, and I would leave that to the council here and the auditor general. But I know in conversations, I was the auditor general for 17 years, so I kind of know how they think there. I know in the auditor general's office, it basically is put controls in place, reduce the chances would ever happen again, and develop a five-year plan. That's generally been the course throughout my whole career before me and continues on. Because remember, we have children to educate here. And that's important to keep in mind. We have to educate the children. So,
Okay, so question number four would be, would the commission recommend quarterly in-person reports be presented to the city council by the school department finance director at specific city council meetings? We think that that would definitely increase transparency. We would absolutely recommend that. Providing timely updates on the financial performance, it creates an opportunity for early identification of issues before they snowball into bigger issues. Meeting regularly, the district and the city could be better positioned to address issues such as revenue shortfalls, expenditure variances, unexpected financial pressure from mandates, rather than waiting until the end of the year and taking an after-the-fact approach, because you can't really fix it once it's already been done. This collaborative approach would also allow both entities to adjust priorities, make informed decisions, and ensure fiscal resources are aligned with the community's needs throughout the year. The Budget Commission will discuss formally recommending that to the district, and we think quarterly meetings are definitely a good idea. So next, okay. So will the Budget Commission be recommending any mandatory state or city oversight, time-sensitive financial reports, or other financial accountability to the city and the city council? I thought that one aligned pretty good with the prior question. So the state legislation, the legislation that created the Budget Commission already built in state oversight by requiring the Auditor General to approve the deficit reduction plan. Beyond this, the commission would not recommend any additional mandatory state oversight. Adding another layer, it shifts the focus away from problem solving and collaboration towards compliance and bureaucracy, and that's never a good thing. So through the Budget Commission process, the city and the district have already begun addressing longstanding issues and building a more collaborative relationship. It's been pretty remarkable to see. Additional state involvement could hinder this progress rather than support the positive momentum that's underway. For that reason, local control should remain the focus. As the school district and city leaders are closest to the issues, and they're the best positioned to make timely informed decisions. And I think personally, to further strengthen transparency and collaboration in the community, considering community input would also probably be a good idea. Nobody knows your district better than your teachers, your paraprofessionals, your parents, and maybe even some of your students. Like, it might be a good idea to reach out and have some type of collaboration with them to see what's going wrong and use that information to make decisions. The next question was, please provide a spreadsheet showing the proposed budget for fiscals 27, 28, 29, and 30, assuming the council approves the $2.2 million, and if they don't. This is going to be incorporated into the five-year plan, which has not been presented to the commission. We've been focusing for the last 5 months on the fiscal 26 budget. The next step now is to address that five-year plan, so that's in the works.
And so you know, we requested from the finance director to develop that first phase of the five-year plan and present it to us. You know, that's their department. They give it to us. Then we'll review the same way we did with this, line by line, year by year, and go over that plan. Understanding that, we know we need this estimated $5 million deficit in 2025. We'll know the real number when the audit's done, but say it's 5 million, which is a number that's been presented to us, somewhere around 5 million. That's a million a year that has to go into that budget. We know the $2 million that came from the insurance is one-time money. That's gonna have to be built into the first year, year 27, that I told you would be roughly 3 million in the hole, 3,152,000 in the hole day one on that budget. But we'll work that into the plan. But the plan is going to be generated first from the school finance department and then reviewed by the commission, not us prepare it. We're not doing that. They want to prepare it.
The last question, what is the average cost per student to educate in Warwick as compared to the rest of the state? I also provided that breakdown for, I believe it was the fiscal 24. It's the current year that they have, both per pupil expenditure, so that's district-wide per total number of students, again, calculated by RIDE, and then there's another calculation that's done by RIDE. It's the special ed cost per student, so that takes, it drills into that UCOA, and it identifies all the special ed-specific costs versus the number of students receiving those services, and it provides that rate as well. So just to point out, Warwick for the per pupil expenditure, so that, again, that's total per student, is about $25,526 per pupil. The lowest district is Cumberland at $17,011, and then the highest, not district, but education agency, is the Rhode Island School for the Deaf at $112,691. So the range is pretty large. I think Warwick tends to be on the higher side, but certainly not the highest, obviously. And there's so many things that go into it. The chairman mentioned, like, just the social security taxes. So there's some districts that don't pay that. Warwick does. So it's really hard to pinpoint and use that as a driver, I would say. of an analysis, it certainly helps, but there's so much more data that goes into that that it wouldn't be prudent to just use that number, I believe. To point out comparatively, Cranston is 20,637 and East Providence is 23,222. So Warwick's certainly higher than those, but not by a significant amount. On the special ed side, Warwick's about 85,054. And again, that special ed cost specifically per student receiving services. Cranston, 84,824, and East Providence is 101,656. That one's an even harder number to really use, and you probably shouldn't, because every student is different. So every student's services are completely different. It's not an apples to apples. It would be very difficult to use those numbers as a baseline for any real analysis, I would think.
And the other thing too is, this is a perfect time, the five-year plan, for the school department, the school committee, to think strategically. How do you go through those next 5 years? Are we still looking at student population declining? Do we have buildings that need major improvements that you have to fund? Does it make sense to make those major improvements? Does it make sense to lease space from somewhere else that's cheaper as you move forward? So I think what has to happen, I've always said throughout my career, you should never let a crisis go to waste. This is a great opportunity to look at everything and think differently in how you run operations and say, could I provide high quality education in a different form of delivery? And that includes everything, looking at class size, looking at redistricting, looking at the CTE programs, and all the things we discussed tonight. All those things should be thought about. You have 9 months until next year. So 9 months, you can start working on a strategic plan. If you do a performance audit, you'd also have some additional facts to base it on. And it'd be a great opportunity to do some future thinking. To me, and to close out the comments on this piece, is in truly having oversight, you should have accountability, you should have insight, and you should have foresight. The accountability portion is all the controls that the vice chair talked about. The insight is the accountability portion where they're communicating with the council and the mayor's office, the finance directors, quarterly meetings, what you spent this year compared to what you spent last year, roll forward, what does this look like to the end of the year, stopping things before they spiral out of control. That's all insight. And then foresight is that five-year plan. And it's not just running the numbers in a spreadsheet and saying add 4% to all these things. It's actually looking, how can we do it differently in a more efficient manner and provide a high level education in a more efficient manner? That's what should be involved in all of this: accountability, insight, and foresight. Anything else? Okay, so we told you what the number was. We gave you all the information. We believe we answered all your questions. Mr. President, I don't know if there's anything else that you want from us to answer questions or whatever you want us to do. Okay, that's what I understood. So we're done with our presentation, except for the vice chair has a final comment to make.
So it might be a little repetitive, but I thought it was important to say it myself. So on behalf of the commission, I just want to recognize, really emphasize the dedication and professionalism of the new finance director, Mr. Craig Enos. We're very, very lucky as a city to have him to help us out with this mess. Taking on the new role during a period of significant budget challenges and while the budget commission was being formed required exceptional commitment and leadership, which shouldn't go unnoticed. I'd also like to acknowledge the dedication of the members of the finance team, as the chairman mentioned, Kayla Quirk, Yarmaine Rodriguez, and Carlisle Vinson. They really did step up when they had limited leadership during the transition, and they did a wonderful job, and they continued to do a wonderful job assisting us throughout the process. Equally, I want to acknowledge the new superintendent, Mr. Bill McCaffrey. He stepped up, he showed up, and he worked really hard and tirelessly to answer our questions, even if some of them were, I'm sure, redundant. Provide us data that we asked for in a timely fashion, and to help enhance our understandings of the school department's operations and financial challenges. Everybody was super transparent they withheld nothing. It was very, it made our jobs very, very easy. So the efforts of these individuals in identifying discrepancies, reconciling data, and providing timely information were really invaluable. The insights and support provided allowed us to perform a thorough and accurate review of the school department's financial operations, and we're all very, very grateful for their dedication, transparency, and fiscal responsibility. So in closing, throughout this, the chairman and myself both, obviously we are very committed to the community. So we decided that we would like to donate the money that we earned for this job back to the schools. So we've brought checks. We would just kindly have you tell us, probably Mr. Galligan, how we make them out. So, and Sean Galligan, just tell us who we make them out to. So other than that, that is it. Thank you for your time. And if you guys have any other questions, I think you all know how to contact myself and the chairman. We'll be happy to answer them, whatever you need. So
thank you all, and thank you for what you all do.
Thank you very much to both of you. And apparently happy birthday to Ms. Kuntz, who showed up here for hours on her birthday.
Thank you. I wouldn't want to spend it any other way. No.
Next in our docket is acceptance of minutes from the council meeting held on August 18th. Is there any objection to approving those minutes as presented? Seeing none, so approved. Next, we have public comment rule 41. After general communications and prior to the consent calendar at the last regularly scheduled meeting of the City Council each month, there shall be a period of time not to exceed 30 minutes during which citizens may comment about Warwick City government issues subject to the following stipulations. The total period of time for public comment shall not exceed 30 minutes. Comments need to be brief in order to allow as many citizens as possible to participate. Each citizen signed up and present shall have not to exceed 5 minutes to speak, provided, however, that if more than six citizens are signed up and present, that 30 minutes will be split evenly amongst speakers. Time shall not be transferable amongst speakers. The topics for comment shall be issues directly affecting city government. City council members will not respond to questions during the public comment period, and the public comment period session will terminate at the expiration of the earlier of all speakers concluding their allotted time or 30 minutes. Waiver of this provision requires unanimous vote of the council. So we'll come back to the first name because I don't see him. So first we'll start with, I apologize in advance for any pronunciation failures. There are six people signed up, by the way. Danielle Dubai, sorry.
Good evening, Council President and members of the council. My name's Danielle Dubai and I live at 99 Midgley Ave, the last home on the shoreline path that has historically served as the most direct route to the water in my house. This path runs through Safe Harbor Marina, Appanog, and its new owners are blocking long-standing historic access. Homes lined Midgley Ave decades before the marina was ever built, including mine, built in 1914, and always accessible via Midgley Ave. Arnold's Neck Plat was platted in 1909 by Herbert Califf. And in 1911, Califf donated Arnold's Neck to the city of Warwick as a public park. In his will, he said that if Warwick ever decided to no longer maintain Arnold's Neck, Midgley Ave would always remain a public highway to the shore. In recent weeks, the Warwick Beacon has reported on the obstructions at Midgley Ave. I want to thank Senator McKenney, Representative Bennett, and Councilman Kirby for meeting with CRMC to begin the process of formally recognizing this corridor as the right-of-way that it's always been for over a century. But right now, my house and the beach does not have adequate emergency access. The fire department has said they could push through if necessary, but how can they when boats, stands, and trucks are blocking the way? The only other egress to the beach is Arnold's Neck Drive. It's narrow, steep, and not adequate for staging in an emergency. And my tiny 3-foot egress on the Arnold's Neck side is obstructed by 3-foot trash barrels. I have no other place to store my barrels except this small egress path to Arnold's Neck. My barrels are 3 feet, the egress is 3 feet, and they completely block the path. My neighbor has even complained to the mayor that those barrels are impinging on her property line. It makes far more sense for my barrels to be placed on the marina side on Midgley Ave, picked up off of Shattuck, since my legal address is indeed Midgley Ave. I'm a seasoned nurse practitioner, and I know that this is more than an inconvenience. It's a public safety crisis. Children live at my house. People swim in the bay. They walk their dogs on the shore. Emergencies happen both on the water and on land. Midgley Ave has always been the safest and clearest path for response to marina patrons, to residents at my house, and to the public beach. It's not acceptable that the city has not enforced a clearing of these obstructions yet. Would the city of Warwick rather wait until tragedy strikes? And the law is clear. Under Rhode Island General Law 24-6-1, rights of way survive abandonment. That means abutters like me and my home still maintain rights of access, even though the road was abandoned in 58. We'd like the city to put this in writing within a resolution affirming that fact and enforce it. Multiple staircases from Arnold's Neck still lead down to Midgley Ave, and they're still used. They're egresses that residents have used for decades. The marina has no right to threaten people for using these staircases or to threaten to call the police for walking to the shoreline. My property has gotten oil deliveries through the marina on Midgley Ave for the past 60 years. My property also has a public sewer line running through the marina, and it was installed after abandonment with a city easement for maintenance. That's another example of how this corridor has continued to serve homes and utilities.
You have 1 minute, Ms. Dubai.
But above all, it's unacceptable that emergency access is blocked right now. I understand process, but the city must step in immediately to restore access and protect both the rights of abutters and the public safety. You were elected for times like this, our city council, our advocates, our protectors, to stand up against a multinational corporation that's bullying a neighborhood and profiting off our shoreline while blocking the very access our families have relied on for generations. Thank you.
Next, I believe this is Ann Sheridan.
Good evening, gentlemen. First off, the school department's or the school committee's presentation was extraordinary.
I just need you to state your name first. I'm sorry.
Ann Sheridan.
Thank you.
Ward 9. I listened to Speaker Shikachi over and over at the August meeting asking for a 5-year tax treaty for his clients for the property that they plan on building on Post Road. The tax plan that was presented to the council that night showed 15 years worth of treaty. It appears to me that the speaker was suggesting that they were asking for a little more than what the city, for a lot less than what the city was offering. While I don't agree with this plan at all, if the city wants to reward a developer for creating this project, so be it. But understand that it's a reward for something that is not needed, but it will only benefit the developer with legal cash in his pocket. Apartment occupancies are at record highs. The state and the speaker himself speak to that constantly, so there is no need to compensate the developer with incentives. Developers build when they know rentals are in high demand and occupancy rates are almost guaranteed. The fact that 20% of the units will be income limited will be reflected in the assessment during the appraisal process. The appraiser will consider sales, fair market sales, but will also consider the income and the expenses of the properties that, and it will more heavily relate to the income that's impacted by the rent restrictions. There will be no direct tax benefits to the tenants, whether they're low-income people or regular tax-paying people, regular income people. The only benefit of income-restricted taxes is to the developer, so any additional tax treaty benefit will inure to the developer. Again, legal cash in his pocket. Give him the five-year tax treaty the administration wants to give him as a reward to build on the site. Give him the five-year tax treaty that the developer has requested, but not anymore. Anymore is an insult to the taxpayers. Thank you.
So I think this says Marge Pollard. Does anyone have a name adjacent to that, just in case I'm really butchering it? All right, next is Richard Langseth.
Richard Langseth, Budlong Farm. We have tax-free properties in Warwick, churches, charities, libraries, educational institutions. These people come into the city hall, fill out the paperwork, and get exemptions. That's how the law works. The institutions provide services in lieu of taxes. The public wins. The Budwood Beach Association pays no taxes on its streets. So the BBA must be a charity, right? No. The BBA is the developer who owns the streets. It's a private shareholder-owned business. It yells out to the rest of us, stay off my private ways, like many other shoreline entities do. The BBA has a duty to come into City Hall and report its streets to be put on the tax roll. That's the law. But it has not come in 154 years, leaving the streets not taxed. Not only does the public miss the revenues they deserve by law, they get screwed. The public pays for Budwood's water lines, sewer extensions, paving, snow plowing, street lighting, insurance. I figure the uncompensated cost is in the range of $1,000 per Buttonwoods household each year. Over 30 years, the cost to us, the other 35,000 households in Warwick, is over $4 million. What do we get for that generosity? Nothing, squat. That's us squatting before the BBA's private property signs at the pillars of the Buttonwoods Gate. You might ask, why does the Buttonwoods pay no taxes on its streets? The BBA is a land developer. When it platted out its lands, it drew in tax-free streets. Most developers do that. They don't want to pay taxes on the streets. So they draw up plat maps with tax-free streets and bring them into City Hall. The trade-off is public access. The kicker is that the BBA dedicated these streets to the public 150 years ago to get the tax break. Now the BBA goes to the mayor to get him to wink and nod, to agree to privatize the streets without collecting taxes, without a hearing. He says, sure, why not? Why not? Because we get gypped. No tax revenues, yet no public access to the shore. That needs to change. Either take down the no trespassing signs or pay 154 years of taxes and reimburse the city for sewer lines, water lines, street lighting. This is really a simple concept. either pay up or take down those signs. This goes on. I sat here for an hour and 15 minutes listening to incompetence extraordinary. What I'm talking about here is just a little bit of incompetence, but it affects me personally, and it affects, you know, 82,000 people in Warwick.
1 minute, Mr. Langsa.
1 minute? Okay. So, you know, we really have to focus on these kinds of things. Why isn't the Buttonwoods Beach Association paying taxes? They're running around town saying, this is all private. Well, if it's private, they should get down to the assessor's office, and they should announce that their streets are 18 acres of untaxed land and get the city to agree to pay the taxes. Thank you very much.
Next is Darlene Netko.
Hello, Darlene Netko, Ward 7. I've been a teacher for 38 years. I'm at Tollgate, and I'm also president of the Warwick Teachers Union. I went to every one of those, or mostly every one of those budget commission meetings. I only missed two. And I watched the process in action. And at the end of the day, the budget commission presented to you that the schools for fiscal year 26 need an additional about $2 million. It should be noted that that $2 million was the original ask of the administration right from the start. So if the schools had been properly funded from the start, then the budget commission wouldn't have found that now the schools are $2 million short for fiscal year 26. Just a little history here again. I know I've said it before, but it bears saying again. The city underfunded the schools by 5% below the maintenance of effort amount way back in 2009 or 10, the Great Recession. Warwick was the only city or town in the entire state to cut the full 5% and never give it back. So really, the schools have been underfunded for at least 15 years. Add to that the fact that the schools paid the debt service on a bond that they should never have been paying for another 7, 8, or 9 years, about over $1 million a year, and our schools have been underfunded. Throughout this period of time, I need to remind everyone that schools have closed. In 2016, secondary schools closed and were consolidated. In 2018, elementary schools closed and were consolidated. We lost an entire guidance department in elementary. We lost the science department. They have cut, I would go back a few years, we had 1,200 teachers, we have 860 now. This fiscal year 26, the school department cut 45 positions, mostly special ed teachers and special ed teachers' assistants. And right now, I can tell you, there are huge problems in our elementary schools because we don't have the proper number of TAs and special ed teachers. I heard Ernie Almonte talk about class size. Right now, we have classes that are over. And yes, we have some classes that are under. Those are the special ed self-contained classes, and those are some AP classes. So when you look at the AP and the special ed that are small and you figure that in with all the others, you say, oh, we can cut class, we can put more kids in a class. We can't without education suffering. We need fewer kids in a class, not more. The Budget Commission looked at the unfunded mandates, and I know that has come up in this forum on many occasions. The Pathways programs, Mr. Almonte mentioned cybersecurity. Our Career Center has a cybersecurity program. Our Career Center and our high schools have all of the programs that Warwick students are leaving to go to other districts. What doesn't Warwick have? Brand new fields to play on. We are losing students because they want to go play sports in another district, and that's the truth. The only program in this entire state that another district has that Warwick does not and cannot have is the animal science program at Ponagansett. We're not going to do animal science here, but we've got everything else. The problem is with RIDE. The legislation says that if a program is substantially similar, then the sending district doesn't have to send the student. However, RIDE has refused to name anything substantially similar. And Warwick and practically every other district in the state except for Ponagansett and North Kingston, who came in on the ground floor and have been grandfathered with lesser programs. Warwick and all the rest are losing out because we had to create more difficult and more advanced programs that are more than these other districts. But RIDE won't call them substantially similar, and RIDE will say, go ahead, kids, you can go off and play sports in North Kingston. It also bears noting that Mr. Almonte kept mentioning he can't touch salaries and payroll. You're damn right he can't. Those are negotiated contracts, whether they're union, like WISE or WTU, or our administrators that have negotiated their contracts. How can this commission that just came into being have any right to touch anybody's salary or anybody's working conditions?
You have 45 seconds, Ms. Nichol.
They don't. So it would have been an obscenity if they had been able to, and an unfair labor practice. I just want to add, as long as the city saw fit to put a budget commission in place for the schools, it's time for a budget commission for the city of Warwick itself. So we can see where the money is, who's got what and where, and what we all need to run our schools and our city. Thank you.
All right, and now I just want to circle back to the two people I didn't see. First, Rob Cody. And then, again, Marge Pollard. All right, doesn't look like either are here. So next, that brings us to referred business. First, PCO 16-25. An ordinance amending the zoning ordinances of the City of Warwick, 3 Kids LLC, applicant 1112 West Shore Road, Assessor's Plat 333, Lot 103. This would be first passage. This was in public property, so Councilman Ricks.
Recommend opening public hearing and motion to open public hearing.
Motion made, seconded by Councilman Foley. Any objections? Seeing none, public hearing is hereby opened. Now you're going to make me do a roll call. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Abstentions? Bless you. All right, so public hearing is hereby opened. So, petitioner.
Thank you, Council President and honorable members of the Warwick City Council. Attorney Joseph Brennan here on behalf of the applicant, 3 Kids LLC. The proposal that you have before you is generally very simple, although sometimes it can look more complicated on the maps. The property is located at 1112 West Shore Road. It's got an existing single family residence with an existing detached garage. What the applicant's looking to do is to, he's already been to the planning board. We have master plan approval, which is conditional upon a zone change approval here before the council, is we're looking to switch our current zone from A7 to the A7 plan district residential limited overlay district. This is one of those zones that's been created as part of the zoning ordinance and comprehensive plan to allow for greater density, because up until recently, Warwick didn't even have provisions for multifamily, although you do now have them for two families, but this would now turn the property into a three family. So what we would be doing is keeping the existing single family residence, demolishing the existing garage, and somewhat in the garage's space, it's a little bit to the north, putting a proposed two-family duplex, so side by side. The applicant is proposing a parking area right in the front that you can see, which will have access to West Shore Road through his where his existing driveway is, but he would have to open up that curb cut a little bigger. And he would provide ample parking, which was required by the ordinance, which is two spaces per unit. So we have three units, and we'll be providing six parking spaces. And you can also see all the way to the north in that paved area that he has a proper turnaround. That way that last space has the ability to turn around rather than having to back out all the way through. So people would still be exiting West Shore Road forward-facing. No one is rear-facing out onto the road. It's a very busy road, so obviously that safety concern was a big bonus as part of the proposal. Additionally, if you can see on the map, the surveyor did a great job putting the dotted lines, which shows the building envelopes, which is allowed in the zone, will be meeting that criteria from the side yard, the front yards, and the rear yards. So although we did have the ability at the planning stage and through the city council stage to ask for waivers from the dimensional requirements, the applicant chose not to do so and has built everything within those dimensional criteria. Additionally, when you do change the zone to the A7 Plan District Residential, there's a formula that allows for that greater density. That density is 9 units per acre. And by the surveyor's calculations, we have just over half an acre, and we would be able to put 5 units if he wanted to, or if he was proposing. But it's just a further going to show the council he's only proposing 3. So he's really looking at the land area that he has, the ability to park the right number of cars in a way that doesn't stuff it all together, but looks like a very nice, perfect project for the area and the land. After this, if we were to receive the zone change tonight, we would then further proceed on through the planning stages where we would have another public hearing, our third one, for preliminary plan review. And hopefully we would be able to do final either combined with preliminary or at an administrative phase afterwards. If the council has any questions, myself or the applicant is here, we'll do our best to answer them. Thank you.
Does the administration have anything they want to add? Also, make sure if you're not speaking for members of the council that you turn your mic off, because you can hear the system start to freak out when more of us have our mic on.
Tom Kravitz, City Planning Director. Nothing to add, Council President.
All right, Councilman DeLuise.
Yes, I'd just like to say that I've been by the property. Well, I drive by it pretty much every day, and there's plenty of room there. I walked it, and I don't see that there would be an issue. There's no the comments, or there's no negative impact to the city, and it would be providing more housing space. So changing it from A7 to A7 PDR, I would recommend that it would be a positive thing.
Councilman Ricks.
Thank you. I also reviewed the documents as submitted. It seems that the applicant has done a very good job with preparing the packet, going through the proper process here, and just looking at the numbers as well, it adds up, just as Councilman DeLuise and Attorney Brennan had stated. I'm seeing that, according to the tax assessor's website, this property is over a half acre. It's currently zoned A7. It appears from the tax assessor's data that it's 0.56 acres, which works out, and pardon me, I don't have the precise numbers. I didn't go and look at the deed itself in land evidence records, but works out to somewhere in the area of 24,000 square feet. So it seems perfectly suited by the numbers. to have plenty of space for that single-family house, along with an additional two-family house. Seems everything was done properly. And of course, I would, in these land use matters that are specific to and affecting a particular ward, I would tend to defer to the city councilor of that ward, as they are the ones who would be most likely hearing from the various abutters, if those abutters had any concerns or complaints. So for all of those reasons, while I would wait for the public comment to make any type of final decision here, I would say that it looks like everything was done properly here. And I would thank the applicant for doing their due diligence. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other members of the council want to speak before we switch to public comment? Seeing none, is there anyone here to speak against the proposed project? Pardon? First, anyone in favor of the proposed project here to speak? Anyone in favor? Anyone in favor? Anyone in favor? Anyone here to speak against the project? Anyone here to speak against the project? Anyone here to speak against the project? Anyone here just to speak on the project at all? Anyone here to speak on the project at all? Anyone here to speak on the project at all? Seeing none, does anyone want to move to close the public hearing?
So moved.
Motion made by Councilman Ricks, seconded by Councilman Foley. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Any abstentions? All right, so the public hearing is hereby closed. Any further comment from members of the council? My only 2 cents is just to, I assume the administration's gonna ensure that the comments from directors will be addressed prior to the conclusion of the process. But given that this process as a whole is far from over, I assume that the answer is yes. Yeah, not of affirmation from the audience, so yep. So if there's no further comment, I believe clerk can call a roll unless I'm missing something. Ah, fair point. So is there a motion for favorable action?
Motion for favorable action.
Seconded by Councilman Foley, Councilman Napa. Any further discussion on the motion?
Second.
Seconded by Councilman Lattiser as well. Seeing no further discussion, clerk will please call the roll.
Mr. Sinapi?
Yes.
Mr. DeLuise?
Yes.
Mr. Foley?
Yes.
Mr. Gephardt?
Yes.
Mr. Kirby?
Yes.
Mr. Lattiser?
Yes.
Mr. Muto?
Yes.
Mr. Napa?
Yes.
Mr. Ricks?
Yes.
9 yes, first passage.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And thank you. All right. So unless there's a strong objection, we're going to move back to intergovernmental because there are some appointments. And I believe from there, we will go to finance unless there's something I'm missing. So if the intergovernmental committee could convene, please.
Good evening. The time is now 8:20, and the Intergovernmental Committee comes to order. First order of business, the acceptance of minutes from August 18th, 2025. Do I have a motion?
Motion to move favorable.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Is Mr. Hannon present? Okay, Mr. Hannon not being present, I am reviewing this. Appears to be a new appointment, right? Per our rules, for a first-time appointment, we do need Mr. Hannon to be present. So I'm looking for a motion to hold that.
So moved.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. Next up, we're going to hold that to October 6th. All right. Next up, Michael Logar. Mr. Logar, are you present? Okay, we will hold this one for next time as well.
Make a motion to hold.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Lastly, we do have a reappointment tonight that we can act on. Mr. Jeffrey Giusti, who is a member of the King County Water Authority from Ward 9. I did receive communication from the Kent County Water Authority that they were very interested in retaining Mr. Giusti on this board. They actually had better record keeping than we did because they were the ones to flag that it was time to get this one done. So being a reappointment, he's not required to be here. Does anyone have any questions, comments, concerns? Hearing none, do I have a motion? Members of the council, questions, comments, concerns? Members of the public? Okay, seeing none, I have a motion.
Motion to move favorable on appointment.
Moved by 3, second by 6, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Okay. Lastly, we have PCR 9225 resolution relative to the city council meeting calendar for 2026. This is Council President Sinapi. Would you like to introduce this?
I think we have one modification for that one for the September meeting. I'll defer to the solicitor.
The council president is proposing one amendment to this, and that is to make the a single September meeting on September 14th instead of September 21st.
It was Yom Kippur.
Yom Kippur is the 20th and the 21st, so we will move it for if the council's pleasure.
And did we? Okay.
Just can I make an observation on that? So Rosh Hashanah falls on the weekend. When is the observed day?
Well, it's tonight. So,
yeah, this is why this came up, because someone alerted us like, hey, you scheduled this on a holiday. And we're like, oh,
Shana.
Well, weren't supposed to do that. And now I was like, well, we should look at the upcoming calendar. And sure enough, Yom Kippur fell on the proposed date, the original proposed date for September. So hence the proposal to move it to a different day.
According to a quick Google, that would be complete by Sunday the 13th. So the 14th would be in order. Okay. Any discussion about the proposed changes? Councilman Lattiser.
Thank you, Chairman. So the first time we've ever had one meeting in September since I've been on the council, and even before, to my knowledge, we've only had one meeting, and that's this year. I'd like to know what the reason is for only scheduling one meeting again next year in September.
Does anyone have the reason?
The solicitor asked, hey, do you want to do it again? And I said, well, if it worked this time around, then sure. People seem to be on board with it for this time around. Obviously, if that's not acceptable, then we schedule two.
Well, with all due respect, I don't think it's appropriate. When every one of us ran for office, we knew what the days were and what the meetings were. To schedule just one meeting 3 months in a row has led to where we are tonight with 41 bids. The reason is, well, you only have one meeting in July, you only have one meeting in August, one meeting in September. What do you expect? To have only one meeting in September I don't know what the reasoning is, but if someone is unavailable to attend two meetings in September, then so be it. You don't go. But that shouldn't facilitate or determine that the rest of us are only going to be here for one meeting. Because next year, you're going to hear the same thing. We're going to hear the complaints that there's only one meeting in July, and that's why we had to hit the bid package so hard. There's only one meeting in August, and now you guys are doing one meeting in September. I don't think that is productive.
It's a perfectly reasonable opinion.
I have a question. Is there anything that would prevent the Finance Committee from meeting 10 times in September?
That wouldn't be an objection on my part.
Just the only thing I'll point out is September is, this upcoming September is somewhat frustrating date-wise. The first actual week of September where there's a Monday is Labor Day. And then we all now are all aware of the 21st being a holiday. So we could, if there was an appetite for the two meetings in September, we likely would be looking at one of the weeks being a Wednesday meeting. The other problem is the solicitor wisely tried to avoid the back-to-back week meetings because it ends up being, in short, less productive than it should be when we do that, is the mild way of putting it. So if we wanted to do two, because right now it can't be the 21st, so the 14th and the 30th, but that would give us the back-to-back. Well, I guess first should be people decide whether it be a straw poll or whatnot. Do you want to do two meetings in September or not? If the answer is yes, then we got to figure out when to have those meetings.
Well, I think the issue with, so you're going to have back-to-back meetings wouldn't be the first time. We've had that numerous times.
Absolutely correct. Yeah, it's not I don't think it's a deal. I don't think it's fair to say it's a end all or be all or a deal breaker. If we have to, we have to.
I think it's a disservice to the public for us to have one meeting in September and one meeting 3 months in a row.
And just before you go, just so I can get in my head straight, the change here, though, isn't eliminating a meeting in September. The change is just changing the date of the one meeting that we already have scheduled for September.
Adding another one.
So my proposed change was just moving the one that we have. Councilman Lattiser has raised the prospect of doing two meetings in September.
We've already approved a calendar with one meeting in September. Is that right?
No.
No.
This is our first attempt at this.
Yeah, calendar. It's just the first try.
I see. Okay.
Sorry.
Apologies.
No, not your fault. We didn't present it as articulately as we could.
Mr. Chair, Mr. President, I can give some background to kind of the organization of this, plus the proposed change that would be for consideration. There were varying objectives that we've tried to keep in place that have been at least given feedback from us that has been favorable, particularly maintaining Monday night meetings for predictability's sake, as people historically in the past have had other issues on midweek meetings. And because of the volume of Monday holidays throughout the calendar year, that poses problems. There was frustrations over the years regarding having consecutive meetings in back-to-back weeks because of the overlap of things, and the drafting in between resulted in things not being as organized. And so stretching it out and avoiding back-to-backs was another priority that was endeavored towards. The September meeting ran into issues with the very late Labor Day falling on Monday the 7th, and with the holidays previously noted. Given the fact that we had a singular meeting proposed for this year, it was at least started as a baseline for your consideration to continue similarly. But it's a fair observation that is a concern of yours. That be said, there's no there's always the availability for special meetings at the call of the majority, the president and the mayor. to fulfill other obligations that present themselves as well. But avoiding holidays, avoiding Wednesdays, avoiding back-to-back meetings, and trying to map it all out was the intention.
Well, when I voted for this calendar last year, I never voted for it to be the new rule or the new norm. I voted for it because it was an exception to the rule. And as I understood it, or at least interpreted it, it was going to be a one-time thing. This calendar, we're talking about it a year in advance. So, I mean, you get the city calendars, you get the city websites, you get all the notice, et cetera, et cetera. There's plenty of notice for folks if we have a one-day change. So in September of 2026, why couldn't you have a meeting on Monday, September 7th, and the second meeting on Wednesday, September 23rd?
September 7th is Labor Day, but your point is still well taken as far as the prospect for
two or so. There's other times that we can do it if you really want to do two meetings. If you just want to cut it back to one meeting, fine. So what do we do next year? Do we just say, let's just do one meeting in June because we have all the budget hearings to do and I don't feel like sitting here for three or four meetings? So some people may like that idea, right? But I don't think the taxpayers would appreciate the business section or session being cut short. But it's your pleasure. I will vote no on one meeting.
Councilman Ricks.
Oh, I skipped you.
Thank you. I would also suggest that another complication with the September calendar in an even numbered year is that the statewide primary would be on a Tuesday, September 8th, the day after Monday, Labor Day. So even if we were to have a meeting scheduled on the Wednesday following, well, I know a lot of my fellow councilors will spend the full 13 hours at the polls on that Tuesday greeting voters. So that would tend to be more time greeting, speaking with constituents, less time available for actually preparing for the meeting that particular week. I would suggest that if we wanted to go in the direction of an additional meeting, it may make sense to have two meetings in August, but then of course that comes with its own set of complications there, especially since the summer meetings, July and August, those aren't necessarily the best times for public participation either, given that so many people have different trips, etc., during the summer. So there is no easy solution here in particular. And I'm not saying that one way is necessarily better than another. I don't necessarily have a strong point of view on this. I don't think it's the worst thing in the world that a September meeting like the one tonight may wind up going late. That's also part of the job. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you for your patience, Councilman DeLuise. Go ahead.
You don't want to hear what I have to say. Can I make an amendment, Mr. Solicitor, to have two meetings in September and we can figure out the dates later? Because we're wasting too much time on this topic right now, as far as I'm concerned. This is doing a disservice to me, never mind the public.
My suggestion would be if we want to get into amendments, we should do them on the floor with and not in committee.
All right.
But you're welcome to do so. My suggestion would be, since it's advisory, to move the item to the full council and let the populace decide from there.
I think that's a good call. So let's any other discussion amongst the committee, amongst the council? How would we
motion to move this to the full council without recommendation.
A move without recommendation made by 3, second by 6. All in favor? Aye. I did ask. Did I ask public? Public? Anything to add? Mr. Rotundo? Anything? Anything to add? Okay, hearing none, that was a motion by 3, a second by 6, and 4-0. And that is all the business of the Intergovernmental Committee. Thank you all for your time and your patience.
Mr. President, call for a 10-minute recess, please.
Okay. Sure. Okay. We'll take a, we're going to take a brief recess and come back. Just give a vague term, brief, however long it is.